All right. Well, welcome everybody to another Channel 9 Expert to Expert. And today our guest is Leslie Lamport. When I was a young Eric, long time ago, I was really deeply interested in mutual exclusion algorithms. And they had like fancy names in those times. Like there was the Dutch beer algorithm. And then the other famous one is the bakery algorithm. And so that's kind of, you know, how I first met Leslie Lamport. And I'm really excited to talk to him today.
Thank you, Eric.
Welcome. So, talking about the bakery algorithm.
Yes.
So you, if you look at your work, what I really, what strikes me, what I really like about your work is that you're always looking for kind of, you know, the essence in things. And for example, in the bakery algorithm, you know, at that time, people thought that, you know, you might need some extra primitives to do mutual exclusion, but you showed that, you know, you can just do it with reads and writes. Can you explain a little bit about, like, you know, the what's behind the bakery algorithm for our viewers?
Well, the story behind it might be of some interest. Someone showed the mutual exclusion problem to me, which, as I presume most of the viewers know, it's a problem of having a bunch of processes that want to access a critical section and making sure that they can only do it one at a time. And I just looked at it and said, oh, that looks really easy. And so I dashed away with an algorithm and I sent it to CACM, communications of the ACM, where such things were published in those days. And a few weeks later, I got back a letter from the editor pointing out the error in my algorithm. That got me pretty mad at myself. And I decided that I was going to solve that damn problem. And the idea came to me of the way that problem is solved in real life, or the way it was when I was a child in our local bakery, where there was a roll of tickets. And customers would come in and just pick a ticket. The tickets were numbered. And the customer with the lowest numbered ticket was the one who was served.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized, well, couldn't have printed tickets. But so I had an algorithm where each process looks around and sees what other processes have numbers and picks its number bigger than any that it sees. And I looked at it, and this time I was more careful, and I reasoned very precisely about, you know, or as carefully as I knew how to at the time, that it was correct, and it seemed correct to me. And in the course of it, I made a remarkable observation. As I wrote my proof, and when I looked through the proof, I realized that there was nothing in the proof that depended on what happened if one process was reading a number while another process was writing it. So I realized that if one process was changing its number from 0 to 27, and another process read 15 at that point, the algorithm still worked. And what that meant is that it really didn't, this my solution, didn't really depend on any anything underneath the covers preventing one process from reading while another process was writing, which meant it really solved mutual exclusion without assuming that there was any lower-level mutual exclusion. And I think I was probably as surprised as anyone afterwards.
Yes, yeah.
When I realized that.
Okay, so that was not your goal, but that was something that you discovered afterwards.
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. So another thing that, you know, talking about, like, you know, what is the essence of concurrency, if you look at, you know, your papers, which I can recommend, by the way, everybody to go to Leslie's homepage, and he has, like, a huge list of papers, and all nicely with, like, a little description of, you know, like a little history about each paper. One of the interesting things, and that always has fascinated me too, is this notion of arbiters, right? So it's like, you know, at some point, you know, if there's real concurrency, how do you kind of really decide, you know, who was first? And you have written a couple of papers about that. Can you explain that problem to us?
Well, that's a problem that has a wonderful history. I heard about it. In fact, a colleague mentioned that work after reading the bakery algorithm. And it's a problem that was first recognized in hardware when you have what happens in hardware is you have the process, the computer has its clock that goes tick, 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 and it has signals coming in from the outside world, interrupts. And the machine has to decide whether, you know, on which cycle an interrupt occurred. And if the interrupt occurs, comes in, you know, just as the clock is ticking, well, did it come before or after the clock tick? And what people realized is that there's a fundamentally unsolvable problem there, which is you cannot build a circuit that's going to make that decision in a bounded length of time. And you have to do it in a bounded length of time because the computer has to decide, you know, within this clock cycle whether it's going to do the interrupt or honor the interrupt or do whatever else it's doing. So there was I heard the story that there was a meeting of computer designers sometime in the early 70s. And there was a mea culpa affair where the computer designers, and I believe one of the early DEC, either the PDP-10 or the VAX, suffered from that problem, that every once in a while, because things happen too quickly, you had a situation where instead of the machine decides, you know, either, you know, no, it didn't happen, it's a zero, or yes, it did happen, it's a one, it produces a one-half. And machines are not very happy with one-halves, and they you start having a one-half signal propagating through a machine, and pretty soon your machine is going to crash. And I believe that DEC machine crashed, I don't know, the order of once a week because of that problem. Once a week was not very often for computers to crash in those days, but still often enough that people worried about it. And they,
if that's your pacemaker, yeah.
And they eventually discovered that the solution of how to solve the problem in practice, which is to, instead of deciding, you know, did this interrupt happen this cycle or the next cycle, is did this interrupt happen 15 cycles ago? So you would have 15 cycles for the circuitry to settle and for it to make a decision. And if you add this extra delay, you can reduce the probability of that happening to being negligible. And that's what knowledgeable circuit designers do. Of course, every now and again, you run across some not-so-knowledgeable circuit designers, and you hear about tales in which some piece of circuitry, generally not a computer, but, you know, some integrated circuit or something, will crash every once in a while because of this problem.
And so I think you also kind of once noticed that this kind of, that humans also kind of exhibit this kind of, you know, decision thing. And to just give you another example, what I once heard people explain this problem to me is like, if you put a dog exactly in between, you know, two buckets of water, the dog will take an unbounded amount of time to decide, and he will starve to death because, you know, it doesn't know whether to go left or right.
Yeah. Well, actually, the history of this problem, it's known to philosophers as Buridan's ass, although it actually, Burton did talk about a dog. Burton was a 15th century French philosopher, and he used it as an example to try to prove the existence of free will, because you don't see dogs dying of thirst because they're in between two buckets. But what nobody seemed to realize, certainly none of the philosophers, is the reason that you don't see dogs, you know, dying in the streets for that reason, is that the probability of finding just the right spot to, you know, for it to take more than, you know, a second or two is, you know, vanishingly small.
Yeah.
But the thing that I wondered is, you actually see this phenomenon in daily life. The way I always happens to me is that if I'm approaching a stopped traffic light that's just turning, and I have to decide, am I going to stop or am I going to go through? And there's this period of indecision where I waver. And by, you know, sort of simple mathematical argument, it is possible that I will wind up sitting stopped in the middle of the intersection because I was unable to, you know, decide.
Yep.
Fortunately, that hasn't happened yet. It seems to be very improbable. But the thing that I wondered was whether real accidents happen that way.
Yeah.
In particular, I remember reading many, many years earlier about an accident at a railroad crossing where I believe a school bus had stopped at the crossing and started to go across, but hesitated and somehow was just in the middle of the tracks and was hit by the train. And nobody could, was able to explain that because, you know, it's perfect visibility. And I wondered whether, could that have been the cause? And do such accidents happen? And I realized that no one would know because nobody was aware of that problem, and it would never occur to anyone. So I wrote, it's one of the stories you'll find on my webpage, so I wrote an article for Scientific American about that, and submitted it. And it came back with four referee reports, two of them positive, two of them negative, that literally ranging from, this is an important paper which needs to be published, to, surely this is a joke.
So in some sense, those views reflected the kind of actual problem.
And I learned that there's a history of inability to publish in the computer area. Charlie Mulner, a late hardware designer, said that he submitted a paper to an journal about, you know, something to do with this problem, and it was rejected. And one of the referees' reports says that if this were a real problem, it would be important. And I'm an expert in the area, and I would have heard about it, but I haven't heard about it, and therefore it can't be important. The story that I heard in the late 60s, a designer at General Electric realized this problem and tried to convince his superiors about it, and nobody would believe him. And so he submitted a letter to it, about it, to some technical journal, which was published, and as a result, he was fired. Now, that's a story that I've heard. I can't attest to it, but on the other hand, it's consistent with the tales of this. And it used to be that if you told this to, you know, the problem to an engineer, they wouldn't believe you. They would simply say, you know, come up with some device which just, if you can't make a decision, then decide not, you know, to flip a coin. But then, of course, you have to decide whether you've made a decision or not, and so you just push the problem back one level. But the first time you tell that to most people, that's their reaction. I hope by now, all hardware designers know that it's a real problem. But
Well, the interesting thing, I think, in certain sense, like, you know, I think people maybe kind of, you know, analysis paralysis, kind of, you know, this the kind of the inability to decide, you know, you run into that in real life a lot when you're kind of designing something and you don't know, you know, what the right choice is. So I think that problem is probably more widespread than people realize. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so going from there... another very interesting piece of work that you have done has to deal with time, and time in distributed systems, synchronizing clocks in distributed systems, or even like, you know, the notion, like a very abstract notions of time. Can you explain us a little bit about that?
Well, I think what seems to set aside to what makes the research that I did different from what other people certainly were doing, and perhaps still doing, is that most people view concurrency as a programming problem or a language problem. I regard it as a physics problem. The mutual exclusion, I mean, it's not about processes or, you know, about language, you know, coding or something like that. It's this basic problem of how do you keep two things from happening at the same time? And at the same time is a physical concept. That's probably why the arbiter problem fascinating mm-hmm. so much. It's physics. And so thinking about things physically, and knowing a little bit of physics made me realize that when you have a distributed system, the notion of things happening at the same time in two different places is not a physically meaningful one. Now, if you know any special relativity, this is, you know, obvious. So what I did is I, you know, wrote a paper about explaining that I think there were three or four references in that paper. One of them was to, I think, an earlier paper of mine. And the others were all to texts on special relativity, and basically translating, you know, what Einstein discovered in 1905 into the domain of distributed computing, and shortly after it was published, chatting with Jim Gray. And he said that he'd heard two comments about that paper, you know, or two classes, you know, of reactions to it. Some people thought it was brilliant, and some people thought it was obvious. Well, I certainly couldn't argue with the latter because it is perfectly obvious if you know any relativity, and I was not too inclined to argue with the former, so...
Yeah. So can you? I would like to dive a little bit deeper into this. So like, you know, when people say, you know, there's like kind of the Lamport clock. What does that mean?
Well, what I realized, and I mean, what made my paper computer science, not physics, is that the. In order to design a distributed system, the fundamental problem that needs to be solved is to decide in what order things happen. So, for example, you have two requests that come in, and you know, you obviously want to honor them in perform the actions in a in some order, mm-hmm. and the obvious order is, you know, first come, first serve. But the notion of first come is not meaningful if those two requests happen at, you know, in separate locations.
Yep.
And so, although which one, there's no meaningful way to say one happened first rather than the other, but what you have to do to build your system is to have some way of deciding which one happened first. And if there's no natural sense in which one preceded the other, then the decision is arbitrary, but it still has to be made.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I realized is that you can design, given a method for basically ordering the events in a distributed system, you could implement any system you wanted using that, because you can describe your system as a state machine, namely something that takes in, you know, inputs and has a current state and changes state and produces an output. And that's, you know, determined by, you know, a simple rule that tells you what to do. And you know, anything can be, you know, any discrete system can be described that way, whether it's, you know, the kind of thing that you usually think about as a state machine with little boxes or arrows, or, you know, a 4 million line C program. It can also be viewed that way. And so what Lamport clocks are is a mechanism for doing that ordering of the events in the distributed system. The unfortunately, people read the you know, the clocks and the pictures of messages flying back and forth, but for about, I don't know, 10 years, nobody seemed to notice that it said anything about state machines. I mean, I've had the experience of talking to someone who, you know, said, there was nothing in that paper about state machines. And they were so adamant about it that I had to go back and read the paper again myself to make sure that I wasn't hallucinating.
Okay.
But in fact, that was the, you know, what I think is the really important thing stated in that paper, which is that to implement the machine, you specify it as a state machine. To implement a distributed system, you specify it as a state machine, and then you use a general method for implementing a state machine. And later work, I extended that to deal with implementing fault-tolerant distributed systems.
Okay, so I would like to put that one on the stack for a little bit, because that is on my list. But I would like to kind of take a little bit side path, because you said something really interesting is that you kind of look at computing from a physics point of view. Now, two questions come in my mind. Then is like, and you mentioned this yourself, is like if you have a discrete system, but in physics often we're talking about continuous systems. So how do you see that kind of, you know, duality, or I don't know if it's a duality between discrete and continuous systems? And do you think that there's a role for continuous things in computing, where, you know, values change in a continuous way? Or,
well, what distinguishes computing from other, let's say, scientific subjects that deal with the real world, is that it is the study of the discrete. And we in some sense, the whole problem in designing a computer is to get a continuous system to act like a discrete system. Now, people do work with what's called hybrid systems, where you're dealing with a discrete system and describing its interaction with the continuous environment, and you read some papers I've written. It's especially paper with my colleague Martina Botti, you'll see that there's no problem using the same methods that we use for thinking about discrete systems to have them use them also for thinking about hybrid systems. But the essence of computing is discreteness. And I believe that what one will discover is that the essence of perception is discretizing something. That is, perception means receiving this continuous input from the environment and making a discrete categorization of it. And that's the point at which perception happens. Actually, one of the things that interested me about the arbiter problem is that there is some, I don't know if what the current thinking about this is, but there was, when I was looking at the problem, it was never quite clear whether the brain was a discrete computing device. Because although firing of neurons is a discrete event, information is also carried by the frequency of firing. And it occurred to me that one could use the arbiter problem to decide, to experimentally check whether there are whether this kind of discretization is happening inside the brain, because if there is this discretization, there will be this arbitration point, and you will have this situation where it can take an unbounded, a theoretically unbounded length of time to do that. And I talked to a psychologist and got the impression that although in principle it sounds nice, in practice it would be rather just practically impossible to actually do the experiment. There would be problems like the exact point at which that happens would vary with with time. And oh, it reminds me, I did discover this another tale about the arbiter problem. When I was looking at the psychology literature, I came across one paper in which had an experiment in which it mapped the time it took a subject to discriminate between two choices. I think which of two sounds happened first, I think it was, as a function of how close together the sounds were. And as you expect, the closer together the sounds were, the longer it took. And the interesting thing about the paper is that it had some theoretical model. And the theoretical model had an asymptote, that is, at zero separation. Mm-hmm, yeah. He had a drawing of the theoretical curve. It went up to infinity. He then graphed the points. They followed quite accurately that theoretical line. And he then drew the experimental curve like this. And there was not a single mention of that discontinuity in the paper. It was the elephant in the living room. As a footnote to that, this was back in the early 80s, I believe. A year or two or three ago, I decided to look up that author on the web, and I found his address. He was still at, an Australian university. And so I sent him an email saying, what about this? Asking him for the problem of the discontinuity. He said, oh, I'm traveling now. I can't answer. I'll be back in a few months or something. Didn't hear from him. A few months later, I sent him the email again, asked him the question. Never got a reply.
Well, maybe he is watching, so yeah, time to reply. So one last question about the kind of, you know, computation and physics. I must admit up front that I don't know much about this, but if you look at quantum computing and the notion of entanglement, now you might get like real kind of strange things where things do happen kind of, you know, at the same time in different places. So what do you think about that? Is that something that, yeah, what is your opinion about quantum computing how do you see that?
I don't have an opinion about it. Sure. I've never, you know, studied it. I've, you know, looked at it, and I was first heard about it. I was skeptical, but I looked at it, and you know, clearly it works. In the arbiter problem, people have invented quantum mechanical arbiters. That the idea being that since in quantum mechanics, you have discrete states. You can apparently build an arbiter that works in a bounded length of time. And that's discussed in my paper. What I do is I present one of these quantum mechanical arbiters, and then, you know, sort of say, well, what's the problem with it? And then I point out the flaw, why it really isn't a bounded time arbiter. And the reason is something I find rather mind-boggling, and I'll let interested people read the paper and see, but the way it brings in some principle from left field to defeat this arbiter just tells me that there's something very basic going on in the physics. Unfortunately, in the 70s, I tried to look at that problem quantum mechanically, and it turns out that it couldn't be done because quantum mechanics is in this very funny state in which there you cannot explain quantum mechanically what it means to make a measurement because basically the laws of quantum mechanics say that what happens when you make the measurement can't happen. I've recently, in the past year, learned that there was some physics that started about when I stopped looking at it, at the physics, that may lead some to some insight into that. So it may now be possible to go back and talk about the arbiter problem in terms of quantum mechanics, but I haven't had the time to learn enough about that work to be able to say yet.
All right, good. So now let's go to fault tolerance, and so you have done a lot of work on PEXOS. Can you explain, you know, what that is and what the problem is that it tries to solve?
The problem it is solving is implementing a fault-tolerant distributed system. As I said before, the basic problem to solve to implement a distributed system is determining, you know, the order in which events occurred. For fault tolerance, you have the additional problem of not simply determining the order in which events occurred, but what events occurred. Because if we don't worry about a process failing and an event happens in a process, well, that process will be able to tell you about that event. But if you want to build a fault-tolerant system, then the system has to continue even if that process has failed. And so you can't ask him about, you know, whether that event happened. And you can wind up in the additional complication that, you know, some of the processes may have heard about that event from that failed processes and others haven't. And so what you wind up with is something that we abstracted as the consensus problem. So by using this fundamental building block of consensus, you can then decide not just the order of in which events happened in the distributed system, but which events happened in the distributed system. And once you have that, you can implement an arbitrary state machine with a distributed system. So starting from this single building block of consensus, which is the heart of the Paxos algorithm, mm-hmm. you can then implement any reliable fault-tolerant system. So Paxos is a consensus algorithm that only tolerates omission failures. That is, processes crashing, you know, messages getting lost. It doesn't tolerate what we call Byzantine failures, which is processes, sending one message to one guy and a different message to somebody else, or, you know, data getting corrupted. There are actually Liskov and Castro invented a Byzantine version of Paxos that you can use in that situation. In the sorts of applications that Microsoft, the sort of systems that Microsoft builds, the kind of reliability that those systems are required to have, generally doesn't seem to be necessary to deal with Byzantine failures. Mm-hmm. Using simple techniques like, checksums to avoid corruption of data, it's generally felt that that kind of malicious behavior outside of where the malice is caused by failure, not by hackers, mm-hmm. You don't need Byzantine fault tolerance. So in practice, that means if the computers that you're building your system out of are under your control. And not under hackers' control, then you don't need Byzantine fault tolerance, and in which case Paxos is basically the algorithm you should be using. There are a lot of variations on different consensus algorithms that have been proposed, but the ones that are practical in the sense that they're efficient are all equivalent to Paxos, at least in the normal case, and Paxos works, and use that. It doesn't solve all your problems because you still have the problem of optimizing. There are lots of optimizations, games you can play depending on the particular nature of the state machine that you're trying to implement. But if you understand the basic Paxos algorithm, then you'll understand what optimizations can be made to get it to be to work well for your system.
And so could you explain kind of the essence of how the kind of the consensus algorithm works, or should people read your paper? Or
I have a paper called Paxos Made Simple, and I'm afraid that if I tried to do it, conversationally, it would probably cause more confusion than explanation.
Okay, so everybody should look at that paper. And again, that's on Leslie's website. Moving on there, it's like, when you're describing complex algorithms like this, you need to have a good language to express that. And that's also something that you've been working on formalisms to specify systems. Can you tell us something about that work?
Well, the basic realization I had, 15 years ago or something, is that if you're not writing a program, you shouldn't use a programming language. because programming languages are really complicated. And they get more and more complicated. Now, they're complicated for good reason. They've got difficult problem to solve, which is to be able to generate efficient code for these complicated machines. But there's a lot simpler way to describe systems, algorithms, whatever. And, it's a language that's been developed for a couple of thousand years for saying things precisely. It's mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what I do is I use math. Now, I've discovered a particular way of using math that makes it, think of it, structuring your math in such a way that it's makes it easier to actually describe things like algorithms and systems. But the idea is very simple. The fundamental thing about a computing device is that it has a state, and it operates discretely, which means it takes a step and goes into a new state. So to describe the computing device, all you have to do is describe how it can go from one state to the next. And the way you describe that is simple mathematical formula. The way I do it, is state is simply an assignment of values to variables. So you mm-hmm. describe a state by saying what the values of the variables are in that state. And so to describe, how you go from the old state to the new state, well, the obvious way is to describe the values of the new variables in the new state as functions of the variables in the old state. But, that's not general enough because it only describes deterministic systems.
Mm-hmm.
And, most of the systems that we're interested in, or certainly, the larger systems are non-deterministic. And so instead you have a relation between the values in the old state and the values in the next, the first state and the second state. And I just write that as a mathematical formula where I, use unprime variables for the old state and prime variables for the new state. So, for example, instead of saying x gets x plus 1, I just write x prime equals x plus 1. The value of x prime, value of new state, is equal to x plus 1. Now, that may seem like a very small difference, but it's an enormous difference.
Mm-hmm.
For example, instead of writing x prime equals x plus 1, I can write x plus 1 equals x prime. Or, x prime minus 1 equals x. Now, you can't do that with an assignment statement. There are lots of other, important things you can't do with assignment statements. For example, the whole nature of implementation or refinement is substitution.
Mm-hmm.
You're implementing, x by a bit string. So, where some array y, an array is, of course, just a function from, the array
yeah.
elements into the values. So, if I wanted to say, what is this, how does this formula supposed to behave? Well, I can't write, if y is an array, I can't write y gets y plus 1, and I can't substitute y for x, but, what I actually do is it's not just y, but there's also a refinement mapping, which says how you map the value of y into a value of x.
Okay.
So what I do, you do, is just substitute that refinement mapping applied for y, call it f. So you say f of y is what you substitute for x. And so you have f of y prime is equal to y plus 1, f of y plus 1, and that's what your implementation has to satisfy. That's the correctness condition.
Yeah.
You can't do that with x gets x plus 1. So math is just wonderful. It really allows you to not only state precisely what it is that your system is doing, but really understand even what it means for the system to do that.
So yeah, that is, I mean, and so the viewers that kind of, you know, that have seen my functional programming course, or a real functional programming course, where it, about programming with functions, is one of the things that always kind of, you know, I wonder about is that people in high school do math and they learn about functions, but then when we start programming, suddenly we're not using math because we're using assignment. And so we lose all the nice properties of math, like substitution and equational reasoning. So, what is the reason behind that? So why don't we as computer scientists use more math? And why are we so addicted to this assignment statement?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, before I knock imperative programming language, let me point out that computation is not about just about functions. If computation were about functions, then quicksort and bubble sort would be the same because they're computing the same function.
Yes.
You know, as I said, a computing device is something that goes through a sequence of states. And what an assignment statement is doing is it is telling you, you know, here is, that's in the new state. And also there's the notion of, you know, this non-determinism, and so that's not, so the new state is not a function of the old state. So functional programming, in a sense, functions that don't solve the problems of programming. On the other hand, imperative languages are clearly using assignment statements, you know, to compute functions, and that's silly. You know, as to why it happens that way, probably a lot of it is historical, but one contributing factor may be the horrible state of mathematics education in this country, and increasingly, I find, you know, in the world at large. For some reason, and I think it has very much to do with the education, you know, how math is taught, people have this idea that, you know, programmers have this idea that, you know, programming languages are simple, but math is difficult,
yes,
is complicated.
Yes.
Which is absurd. I mean, mathematics is so much simpler than, you know, even the most simple programming language. But people have just had fear of math instilled into them. You know, I'm hoping that, well, the tools that we have for, you know, this language that for describing systems, which is called TLA+, which is very mathematics based, people start using it. It teaches them math, and particularly using the tools, well, it makes using math as much fun as programming, and people learn things because they're fun. But it's really, you know, getting people, you know, by the time they're, you know, working for Microsoft, is really very late in the educational process. They need to, you know, get a love of math instilled at a much, much earlier age. Because the mathematics of computing, things like sets and functions and logic, are to computing what real numbers are to physics.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are writing programs, you know, should be as facile with that kind of very simple math as, you know, physicists are with numbers, whereas the computer scientists probably are with numbers. And they just don't get that facility. And it leaves them, I mean, you know, a programmer, you know, who doesn't have that knowledge, you know, that simply gut feeling, you know, understanding and facility with it is, you know, like an accountant who struggles, you know, adding two numbers. It's, you know, it's not the way it should be.
Yeah. So sometimes I this is like a problem that's very dear to my heart, and like, you know, I always, you know, say what you're saying is like, you know, the math should guide you, but sometimes I think is maybe it's also because computer science is so young. If you look at accounting, well, we have been doing, you know, trading between people with money or something for thousands of years, and so the math for that has evolved. And also, if you look at physics and other like engineering disciplines, you know, calculus and so on, they kind of, you know, also over hundreds of years or maybe thousands of years. And is it that, you know, computer science is, or computing is just too kind of young of a discipline that we don't have the right mathematics yet?
No. I mean, the development of calculus, you know, was a revolutionary event. But what was that, 400 years ago?
Yes.
People are still using calculus the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, calculus hasn't developed any. But because it solves the problem. Now, clearly, you know, when you're getting into advanced theories of physics, then they're, you know, bringing in more advanced math. But they haven't had to invent new kinds of math for doing physics, pretty much.
Well, but not after calculus, but let's look at computer science, for example, and like in my area, like semantics, they're still, like, if you look at domain theory or operational semantics, and it doesn't seem to be that that there's like a fixed point yet. I mean, there's still a lot of churn where it's not like clear that there's a winner.
My feeling is that people are looking for a magic bullet in math. There's this wonderful thing, like, you know, somehow you discover the right math and that, you know, it's the math solves the problem for you. It's not the way it happens. I mean, I've seen this for years. I remember my a roommate from college days who was studying linguistics, and he was saying, you know, gee, is there any math that's going to do this for me? And I had to explain, no. When you understand something, then you can find the math to express that understanding. The math doesn't provide the understanding. I find that, you know, a lot of people doing the same, you know, kind, you know, addressing the same kind of problems that I do in specification and verification, you know, are looking for these new math abstractions, you know, new math stuff. And I gave up on that hunt, you know, 20 years ago. I discovered that, you know, for example, for proving the correctness of a concurrent algorithm, there's one basic, you know, method that works, that is by proving an invariant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can package that in, you know, however many ways you want, but there isn't anything that's going to make the proof any simpler. And so what I've done is just taken a method that goes as directly as possible from the problem into the math. And, you know, I have it easy because since I describe the algorithm in terms of math, mm-hmm. it's already in math, so I don't need any semantics to get in the way, you know, to translate from how I'm describing the algorithm into math. And so I don't need some, you know, new-fangled kinds of math to try to, you know, smooth that process or anything. Now, I haven't looked at programming language semantics. I must say I wrote one paper on semantics, and I found that so boring that I never, you know, approached the subject again, because it just struck me that the problem is one of detail and not of anything interesting, and, you know, at least in, you know, mathematically interesting that I saw. And speaking without knowledge of what's going on, my hunch is that people will find is that, you know, all of these new, you know, new kinds of math are not really going to help solve the problem. There's just an inherent complexity because you're dealing with programming languages and they're inherently complex. And just, you know, ordinary math sets and logic and functions will work as well as anything.
Okay, well, that sounds good. So maybe I should go back to the basics and brush up again on my set theory. And I think this is a perfect place to end. Thank you very much. And one last question is, you mentioned that you have the TLA Plus system. Can people play with that? Can they download that? Is that available somewhere?
Yes, it's at the MSR download site. The best thing to do is go to my home page, and there'll be a link to the, it's called the Toolbox. We'd love for people to play with it. I'll have a booth at TechFest next month where people can come and chat with me about the Toolbox. I'll demo it and tell you what it's about.
Well, thank you very much. And see you right next time.